bad enough. After a breathless second, the earth rolled a second time, then stilled. It was a waiting stillness. Almost, Anna thought she could see the wood, as her mate sometimes did, alive with spirits, all of them watching something, waiting. She waited too. But when nothing more happened, Anna turned her attention back to Hester. Anna found the slug caught in a mass of blood and fur at the back of Hester's neck. She untangled it, a small, mangled thing. It burned her hands. If it had been lead, it probably would have killed Hester anyway. Werewolves were tough, but not indestructible. Anna closed her fingers around the slug. Such a small thing, to end the life of a creature who had been alive when the Mayflower set sail. Powerful, ugly, and sad. The fingers of her other hand worked their way into black fur, caressing the wolf who would not care. Anna could hear the faint sounds as the enemies around her died, and she could not feel sorry for them. They were the ones who had brought death here. But the lumpy weapon in the small of her back made her worry for her mate. She could still see in her mind's eye the moment he fell, and only her mating bond had attested that he was still alive. Hester, old and clever, lay dead beside her. In a world where such things happened, Charles could die too. It was only 5 or 6 minutes after the last tremor before the leaves rustled, and Charles, in human form, crawled into her refuge. Light trickled shyly through the canopy of foliage over their heads and touched his braid and the edge of his cheekbone. This time his t-shirt was black. Usually the shirts he wore when his magic clothed him were red. The black one meant that he'd known about Hester, Anna thought, either from the eerie knowing of her death through Bran's bonds with the pack, or from the strange waiting feeling that had followed the last earthquake. Earthquakes weren't as common here as they were in California, but the heart of the Rocky Mountains was a living thing, and sometimes it moved. But the rumble of the ground beneath her had felt more personal than that. "First shot took her in the head," Anna told him, her voice sounding abnormally calm to her own ears. "She dropped before the second shot." Charles's eyes, dark and liquid, watched her carefully. She cleared her throat. She was a werewolf, she reminded herself sternly. Someone who was used to death. The proper mate of Charles Cornick, son of the Merrock. She held out the slug to Charles and pretended her hand wasn't shaking, that her free hand wasn't buried in the rough of Hester's thick black coat, clutching the other wolf, as if letting go would signal the end of something important. Her voice was steady when she spoke. "This is what killed her. It looks weird to me. Not like the bullets we shoot." She forgot to warn him that it was silver. He hissed and dropped the slug. Then he took his focus off her face and dropped it to her hand. Her skin was blistered, she noticed, following his gaze. But that had happened when she opened the cage door for Hester. Now, though, the palm of her hand was blackened and crusted, oozing a clear fluid. She hadn't noticed the pain of it until she saw the burns. She would heal. She turned her palm away from Charles's gaze and hid her hand in Hester's fur. "I picked up the witch gun," she told him, "before I noticed that Hester was in trouble." He closed his eyes and took in a deep breath, and she shuddered from the sadness that he felt, emotion that bled over through their mating bond. Marok's son, Deathbringer, boogeyman of the werewolves, was Charles Cornick. But he was no monster. He mourned Hester's passing, too. He murmured something in Welsh, his father's native tongue, then translated for her.
"Heaven keep us from the fate we deserve."
When he opened his eyes, they were dry. He touched her face with his naked hand, and she could breathe again.
Are you hurt?
Yes. Hurt by thinking he was dead, if only for a moment, when the witchcrafted gun dropped him. Hurt by killing a stranger. Hurt by having Hester die without a chance to defend herself. But that wasn't what he was asking. She didn't think that was what he was asking. No one shot me, she told him, because that was the truth. Just Hester. What about you? He shook his head.
Not a new scratch.
He gave her a searching glance, then ripped off the bottom of his shirt and wrapped it around his hand. Skin protected, he picked up the malformed slug he dropped into the leaf litter mulch that covered the ground. Silver didn't mushroom like lead. It was too hard. Silver bullets, then, were not as deadly to werewolves as legend would have it. The wounds they made were more like the wounds from arrows than from lead bullets, a neat and tidy hole. Werewolves mostly healed human slowly from such wounds. But as long as the hole wasn't in the wrong place, they survived. Right between the eyes was the wrong place. Especially when the bullet inexplicably behaved more like a lead bullet than a silver one. That's silver, she told Charles. So why did it mushroom? It hadn't really mushroomed, exactly. Instead, it had opened up like a flower with sharp-edged petals. But she figured he'd understand what she was asking. He frowned at it.
Winchester had a bullet they called a black talon that deformed like this.
He looked at her.
About the time you were born. It looked scary, but wasn't any more lethal than a standard hollow-point round. Less lethal, actually. But scary-looking sells to a certain segment of the gun market.
He gave her a rueful look.
When the bullet was famously used by a serial killer, Winchester decided they didn't need that kind of notoriety and took it off the market.
He glanced at Hester, and ghosts moved in his eyes.
Someone figured out how to use that design to make a silver bullet that expands. I remember something about...
He closed his eyes for a moment. One of problems people whose age was in the three digits had was that they had a lot of memories to sort through. She'd noticed that sometimes important items didn't shake out until later. Anna wasn't hampered by the weight of too many years. Remember the vampire in Spokane, the one Mercy dealt with a while back? Didn't he make specialty ammunition intended for the supernatural communities? Did his company produce something like that? She'd remember the reference to the bullet from the 90s that had been discontinued because a serial killer had made it famous. Charles opened his eyes and smiled at her.
Yes, that's what I was looking for. You are useful to have around.
Back at you, she told him. And there was some connection between that vampire and Jerry Wallace, the one who paid Leo to make werewolves. She thought she got the name of her first alpha out in a steady voice, but every muscle in Charles's body stiffened and he growled. Leo's dead, she told him firmly. But the money man, the guy with the money and some kind of political clout who seems to be lurking in the background. Charles nodded.
Because Jerry didn't have that kind of money, or those kinds of connections. Jerry used those poor wolves Leo made to try to find drugs that work on us. That part was all Jerry. But the person who knew that Leo had been trying to keep his mate alive by changing beautiful men and you and killing the pack members who objected. The person who knew Leo would be willing to supply the wolves with a little blackmail and money. That person, we didn't find. He's a ghost. Assuming he's all the same person. I get a whiff of him now and then. He was involved in that group of ex-cantrip people who attacked the Columbia Basin pack. He might have been part of the Boston business we ran into last fall.
He tossed the bullet in the air and caught it, his eyes a pale gold. And then he whispered thoughtfully,
"And here he is again. What did you call him? The money man."
Anna looked down at the wolf they had both been trying not to think about too much, or that she had been trying not to think about too much, even as her hands tried to comfort Hester and herself. "Why are we taking time now?" she asked. "I mean, you don't usually talk while there are things to do." "Things like bringing Hester's body back to her mate."
"I'm giving him time," Charles said. "Jonesy."
"He knows she's gone," Anna said. It hadn't been a question, but he nodded anyway.
"The earthquakes. Those were him, I think. We should wait here a little longer. Old creatures are unpredictable when they are grieving."
Anna nodded and untangled her hands from Hester's fur. "Why did they kill Hester?" Her voice sounded too small, but she couldn't help it. Hester wasn't the first dead person, dead werewolf she'd been around. Anna had killed another person today. Shouldn't she be getting over death by now? She was a werewolf, right? She didn't get to be shaken by the deaths of near strangers. She cleared her throat and tried to sound unshaken, or at least less shaken. They tried so hard to take her away with them. Why not wait to see if they could capture her later? The question he answered wasn't the one she had voiced.
"It's all right to mourn, Hester. She is worth the weight of your sorrow."
"I didn't know her," Anna said. "How can I be so sad when I didn't know her? I mean, why mourn her and not that guy I killed? I didn't know her any better than I knew him."
Charles raised an eyebrow. "Aren't you mourning him, too?"
he asked perceptively. But he didn't wait for her to answer his question. He looked at Hester and said,
"I don't know why they killed her. I don't know why they came here or what they wanted. But they were looking for her, for a female werewolf. Maybe because she was female, maybe because she was Hester, and maybe because she and Jonesy were up here, isolated. They knew too much, our enemy. They knew that Jonesy is Fey, though they didn't have any idea how powerful he is. My Da has been worried about the threat Hester and Jonesy represented. Maybe he should have been a little worried about how vulnerable they were. If Jonesy hadn't called us, it would have been months before someone came up to check on them."
"We need to know if this was an isolated incident, if it was aimed at Hester and Jonesy only, or if someone, the money man, maybe, is targeting werewolves living in isolation," Anna said, grateful for something to focus on besides the dead werewolf, the man she'd killed, and Jonesy, whose mate was dead.
"Yes," Charles told her gravely. "All of that."
He frowned.
"I could have captured the last one. He was human. But Brother Wolf..."
He looked at Hester's body and shook his head.
"Brother Wolf thought that it was better to make sure they were all dead."
He raised his chin and looked around them, his head tilted a little as if he could hear something she did not.
"I think we can go now."
Charles rose to his knees and hefted Hester's body until he had her in a fireman's carry. He backed out of the underbrush and stood as soon as he could. He waited until Anna was beside him, then started back toward the cabin. Her mate had grace in the steep terrain, never faltering as he stepped over downed timber or around rocks. He didn't slip, didn't make an unintentional noise, while carrying the huge old wolf. Anna had been raised in suburban Chicago. The closest she'd gotten to mountains were the hills in Wisconsin, where she'd gone to a few summer camps in middle school. In wolf form, she was almost competent, but her human toes liked to stick themselves under tree roots and thunk into rocks, especially when she couldn't see, because stupid tears kept welling up whenever she let her eyes linger on the dead werewolf.
"Should we be worried about Jonesy?" asked Anna.
"As we approach the cabin, I mean."
Charles hesitated, then said, "We should always worry about anyone as old and worn as Jonesy."
Any other day, Anna would have pursued that not answer. But she was feeling as though she'd been knocked off her feet and couldn't quite find her balance, so she let it pass. But he clarified his answer anyway.
You should probably stick close. As much for me as for you. Leo was right. Bringing you was a good idea. It seemed to help Jonesy.
How is that? She asked his back. I noticed it too. Usually I only have that kind of an effect on werewolves.
No, Charles said. I would have said that you affect werewolves most strongly. But watching Jonesy with you, you affected him as much as you affect any werewolf. It might be because he's the mate of a wolf. Or some of the Fae are shape changers.
Anna looked ahead to see what had distracted him. They had just topped a rise, and the trees had thinned, so she could see the valley with Hester and Jonesy's cabin. The happy, sunflower-looking flowers that had been only in the flower boxes had now popped up all over the valley, not densely, like the poppies in The Wizard of Oz, but in small patches here and there. Maybe she just hadn't noticed them. Are those flowers new? She asked.
Yes.
They were pretty, gathered together like natural bouquets. Not elegant enough to be beautiful, but sort of homey and lovely, warm and welcoming. They shouldn't have caused the dread in her stomach. The little cabin was quiet. No soft-spoken Fae came out to greet them. Charles walked right past the cabin without slowing. He just took Hester to the back of the truck and waited, without saying anything. She dropped the tailgate, expecting him to lay Hester's body down, then push it in the rest of the way. Instead, he hopped into the bed himself, then set the body of the wolf down as if she could still be hurt if he didn't take care. Anna wrapped her arms around her midriff, watching him.
He's dead, too,
Anna said, in a low voice. That's why they had waited. That's why he hadn't really worried about Jonesy when they were bringing his dead mate back to him. Charles jumped out of the truck and landed lightly beside her. When he spoke, his voice was heavy.
Probably.
And she remembered that his father had left Hester and her mate in Charles's capable hands. Their lives had been his to protect, and Charles took his responsibilities very seriously. He walked them unhurriedly back to the cabin. She noticed he didn't step on any of the flowers, so she took care not to as well. The door was unlocked. The interior of the cabin was tidy and cozy. A couple of rocking chairs near the fireplace, bookcases stacked with worn books, some of them leather-bound antiques, others modern. There was a small loom with the beginnings of cloth woven only a few inches long, a pale seafoam green. She could smell them here, Hester and Jonesy, but the only sounds were the ones she and Charles made. The house felt empty, as if no one had lived here in a very, very long time. No breathing, no heartbeat. None of the small, shuffly noises that come with movement and living. That lack didn't keep her from feeling like she was violating the private space of someone she didn't know. The main floor was all one room, but there was a loft over half of it. Charles climbed the rungs on the wall that gave access to the loft, but when his head cleared the ledge and he could look over, he just shook his head and dropped to the ground without bothering to use the rungs on the way down.
Here, said Anna.
She whispered because it seemed appropriate, as if she were in a library or private garden where noise might disturb someone else. Here was a trap door in the corner of the room farthest from the door, next to the bathroom door. It was closed, but not in an attempt to hide it. Charles passed a hand slowly over it, close but not touching. Looking, Anna thought, for a trap, magic or otherwise. Once he'd finished, he opened the door and used an eye hook on the wall to hold it open. A narrow, winding stairway dropped into the darkness below, All of the rungs and stringers were carved with fantastical beasts. The stringer was pine, and the rungs were a similar light wood with a different grain. It was a work of art. It was not so dark that Anna's wolf couldn't see as she followed Charles into the basement. As with the main floor, there was only a single room in the basement, dominated by a large bed in the corner. She heard the sound of a match striking. There was an oil lamp sitting on a small bookcase next to the stairway. Lighting it seemed to be a complicated matter, but Charles had no trouble. She supposed that he'd lit a lot of oil lamps before electricity became common. The lamp was brighter than she expected, and when Charles held it high, it shed enough light to illuminate the whole room. The bed had no head or footboard. The bedspread was a handmade quilt, an old-style crazy quilt, the kind the pioneers used to make when every scrap of fabric had been precious, so every bit had been put to use. On one side of the bed was a swath of deep black soil of the sort that would make Asil, the pack's rose-obsessed gardener, hum with pleasure. She could smell as much as see that mixed into the soil were some still green leaves and flower remnants. Lying askew and half buried in the soil on the bed and into the mattress below was a sword. The sword was no pretty movie prop. It was made for killing things rather than impressing an audience. The blade, short, broad, and leaf-shaped, was nearly black. And so was the crossguard, maybe from age, but it looked as though it might have been charred in a very hot fire. The grip looked like leather, old and cracking, like some long-abandoned relic. On the very end of the pommel, a rough gemstone the size of a walnut gleamed, a thing of beauty that contrasted with the grim fierceness of the rest of the weapon. It could have been sapphire, blue topaz, or some other deep blue stone. Charles set the lamp down and pulled the sword free of soil and mattress in a careful movement, shedding all of the particulate matter back onto the quilt. When he had it free, he laid it back down, parallel to the dirt but a handspan apart, careful to touch only the leather of the grip. There was a solemnness to his action that confirmed her suspicion.
"Jonesy," she said.
Upon death, the bodies of some of the Fae, especially the very old Fae, did unexpected things, like become earth and plant matter. Charles nodded.
"You knew he would do this?" she asked. "That's why we waited?"
She didn't know how she felt about that. Charles met her gaze.
"No. Yes. Maybe. I think I expected that he would destroy this mountain, and possibly much more than that, especially if he had an audience. I wanted to give him time to make a different decision, to keep his word to Hester, that he would not harm anyone."
Charles called his Da's house from the house phone and organized a cleanup crew. He'd been lucky that Sage had answered. She was all business. There was none of the political maneuvering that Leia was prone to. Because he was talking to Sage, he could watch his mate through the largish picture window in the main room of the cabin. Anna was leaning up against the truck, staring at Jonesy's parting gift of flowers, or the flowers that the Earth had given Jonesy as a parting gift. She had been hurt, and he wasn't talking about the wounds she'd taken from the silver or the ones she hadn't taken from the flying bullets. His mate had been hurt, and for all his best efforts, he had not been able to stop it. If she had never become the victim of the Chicago Pack's desperation, who would she be? Would she have found someone else, a boy her age, sweet and strong, full of hope, unfouled by centuries of killing? Could she have made a home with some other man, had a dog, a couple of cats, and 2.3 children? The only thing that he knew for sure was that Anna wouldn't have been crying over a pair of dead werewolves, one whom she tried to save, and the other whom she had killed herself. Brother Wolf huffed at Charles's self-indulgence.
"And maybe she'd have been crying over the death of someone else she couldn't save.
Grief is not the sole purview of werewolves. Even more indignantly, Brother Wolf continued,
Maybe she'd have found a serial killer to marry. Maybe she'd have married a gentle soul like herself and always wondered why she was so bored. But she didn't. She found us. She didn't need to find anyone else.
Charles felt Brother Wolf stir restlessly inside him, until he found some surety amidst Charles's guilt.
She would have found us even if she had never met Leo or Justin.
There was no doubt in Brother Wolf.
She has always been ours. She will always be ours.
Charlie? Sage's voice was a tentative question, where she'd been all business before. The change brought his attention back to their conversation.
Yes?
Have you heard from Bran? I mean, we all felt her die through him. Leia thought he'd call the house to see what happened, but he hasn't. She tried his cell, but it went right to voicemail. I know he's supposed to be out of the country, but his phone is a satellite phone. It should work wherever he is. Charles frowned.
Both of us left our cell phones at home. They're in the office. You can check to see if he called.
We know we did, and there's been nothing. We were hoping that maybe he'd gotten in touch the other way.
If something had happened to his phone, Bran could talk to his pack mind to mind. He couldn't hear them in return, but it was still a handy thing.
No.
And wasn't that odd? And unlike Bran. Almost as unlike Bran as taking a vacation in Africa. Sage squeaked, then Tag's soft voice said,
What are you doing with Hester's body and Jonesy's leftovers? He was the sort who wouldn't leave a body.
Charles paused. He'd been going to bring Hester back for cremation and burial, the same as for any pack member who had no other family to make decisions for her. Tag sounded like he knew Hester and Jonesy a lot better than Charles did, better enough to know what would happen to Jonesy's body.
What do you think we should do?
He asked, because Tag wouldn't have voiced the question without having an opinion.
Hester's people burned their dead with their homes and possessions, freeing their spirits from the mortal world.
Tag was enough of a Celt to make that sound poetic, and stubborn enough that he would insist on it now that Charles had asked him his opinion. Charles shouldn't have asked.
It's high summer, he told Tag. The cabin is in the middle of the forest. If we start a fire here, we'll have the whole forest up in smoke.
Tag made a negative sound.
All due respect, he said. But that cabin had a firebreak all around it. I re-cleared it this spring myself. We had rain last week, so the underbrush is damp. If we light it at night, we can keep an eye out for stray sparks.
Tag had been Bran's contact with Hester and Jonesy, Charles realized. Bran liked to do that, give the wildlings some contact in the pack other than himself, in the hopes of helping the wildling to remain stable. Usually, that other person was Charles, Leia, or Asil. If not one of them, he should have at least picked a wolf more stable than Tag, who was nearly a wildling himself. But if the two wolves had known each other from an earlier time, it would make some sense. Outside, Anna pulled the emergency blanket out of the truck and climbed into the truck bed. She shook the blanket out, then, with a graceful flick of her wrists, flipped it to cover Hester.
She was old, Tag was saying, and tough. She survived things that would make your red fur turn gray, and she did it with style, on her own terms. She deserves what we can do for her.
I agree, Charles said. Tell Sage I've changed my mind. We'll still gather all the pack up here to check things out, but it will be a funeral, too. We'll need food and drink, fuel enough to burn the house to the ground.
Gasoline and diesel?
Tag asked, as Anna came into Hester's living room.
Ask Asil, said Charles.
Asil?
Tag said doubtfully.
He's old. Older than me. What's he know about setting a house on fire?
Sage said something that Charles couldn't quite catch.
Oh. Okay, said Tag. That's all right, then. I'll make sure Asil knows he's in charge of the fire. No worries. We'll organize this end of it.
Sage took the phone back. Don't worry, she said dryly. Leia and I will organize this end of it.
Chapter 4 The pack came by twos and threes, on four-wheelers, on motorcycles, or in various four-wheel drive vehicles. Tag came on his backhoe. They retrieved the invaders' bodies first. Those went into Charles's truck, all six of them, while Hester's body was removed to the cabin. By the time they'd finished with that, the whole pack was present. Charles put Leia in charge of figuring out how to get the four-wheelers, now grown into the forest, out without leaving obvious signs that magic had been worked there. It was obviously the most difficult job, and to his surprise, she tackled it with enthusiasm. He'd flattered her, he realized, in front of the pack. And as a result, she hadn't even resented his giving her orders. Maybe Anna was right when she said that Leia wasn't the only reason he and his stepmother had a difficult time with each other. Leia grabbed a half dozen wolves and eventually several chainsaws. It had taken a few hours, but Sage's SUV held the cage Hester had been trapped in, as well as one of the four-wheelers. Leia's truck held the other three, chopped up into parts. Even removed from the forest, the mangled vehicles were an odd sight. Desultory leakage of various fluids attested that they had been running, but all of them had freshly sawn tree bits growing through the metal. Charles didn't know exactly what he was going to do with them. What he wasn't going to do with them was stage them in his father's backyard as art pieces, as Sage had advised. Tag's suggestion of finding out who they belonged to and giving them back was a better one, though the manner Tag wanted to do it in seemed a bit complicated and violent. Brother Wolf was in agreement with Tag. While Leia's team took care of the four-wheelers, Charles set most of the rest of the pack clearing the area around the cabin of anything burnable. He sent the rest out to find any evidence of the invasion, anything that would hold a clue as to who these people were and what they had been about. He didn't expect them to find much. The people he'd killed today had seemed pretty professional. Professionals don't leave clues if they can help it. That's why he was surprised when Asil came back almost immediately to report that he'd found electronic surveillance equipment up in the trees. Charles asked Asil to let the other evidence-hunting wolves know to look for more electronics. Once that was done, Charles pulled Tag off his backhoe and recruited Anna to help the two of them. He and Tag, because they knew what they were looking at when it came to tech, Anna, because she kept him balanced. The events of the day, the fact that Hester and Jonesy had died while under his protection, had left Brother Wolf beside himself. Most of the pack were afraid of him for one reason or another. Normally, it would not have been a problem, but now the others could sense Brother Wolf's anger. Their increased fear enraged Brother Wolf more, creating a nasty snowball effect. Anna took the edge off everyone's emotions, so he didn't end up killing some idiot for the crime of stepping in front of Brother Wolf at the wrong time. Some idiot that he was supposed to be taking care of for his Da, who had not contacted anyone about Hester's death. Brother Wolf didn't like that they hadn't heard from Da, either. On the good side, as it turned out, none of the battery or solar-powered surveillance equipment they found was functional.
Jonesy probably zapped them, said Tag,
from 20 feet up in a lodgepole pine, where he was using a battery-powered drill to extract a camera from its perch in the tree.
He should have told Hester, but he didn't always tell her everything. He didn't like to worry her. Having awesome godlike power meant that nothing much worried him, even if it should have.
Zapped, said Charles, dryly. Tag made a popping sound with his mouth. He liked to sound dumb, even in front of people he knew were wise to him.
Zapped. That's why the innards are all melty-like, and the outards are untouched. Only way I can think of to do that is magical zapping.
He'd gotten the camera off the tree by that point, and opened up the casing. None of the electronics were store-bought. This was equipment built from components by someone who knew what they were doing. That meant that someone, some person, had touched the insides with their hands. Tag brought the opened camera to his nose for a good smell, reclosed the casing to preserve the scent, then tossed it down. Charles caught it, then took a moment to reopen the casing and get a good smell of the ruined camera himself. Outside, it just smelled of the forest, but inside? The faint ozone of zapped electronics, and the peppery smell of the man who'd put this one together. All in all, there had been three people who had worked on the custom electronics placed around Hester's cabin. All of them human. And one of them lay dead in Charles's truck bed. But the other two were still at large. He'd know them by their scent when he ran into them again. Tag's nose was pretty good. He'd know them too. So would Anna. But he didn't bother handing her this camera. She'd already gotten the scent of the three people from the other equipment they'd found. If he could count on Tags letting him know if he found someone different, Charles wouldn't have to have Brother Wolf check each one out. But Tag was Tag. Tag took great pride in letting you fall if you leaned on him too much.
"You knew them pretty well,"
Anna observed to Tag in a gentle voice.
"Hester and Jonesy."
Tag had been ready to drop down, but at Anna's gambit, he paused, hanging from a branch, like a nearly 7-foot-tall, orange-maned monkey swinging gently. He nodded at Anna's comment without looking at her.
"You could say I knew them," he said,
dropping a hand to scratch at his head, his body as relaxed as if he were standing in the living room, or, Charles thought, dangling 1,000 feet over an abyss. You didn't get a permanent spot in the Marrocks pack if you could function properly on your own.
"Hester better than Jonesy," Tag told Anna. "Hester and I were lovers a few centuries ago."
He paused to consider that, his body stilled, so the swinging had been on purpose. Eventually he added,
"Give or take a few centuries, I guess. She tossed me back in the sea, figuratively and literally speaking, as it happens. But we stayed friendly anyway, mostly because she fished me out so I didn't drown. Then she found Jonesy."
He loosened his grip with seeming carelessness that nonetheless gave him a clear drop, despite the hazards of the proliferation of tree branches and small trees between him and the ground. He landed lightly on his feet, for such a big man, jumping from 30 feet up, though he took a little hop like a gymnast who hadn't quite stuck the landing. An accident of position had Tag meeting Charles's eyes just as he landed. Brother Wolf thought it would be interesting to pit himself against Tag. In Tag's suddenly gold eyes, Charles saw the same desire. Tag was a little bit afraid of him, Charles knew. Other wolves might have let that fear cow them, but not Tag. Fierce joy and love of battle sparkled through the pack bond they shared.
"Wouldn't it be fun?" Tag's wolf asked, and Brother Wolf agreed heartily.
Sometimes Brother Wolf was as crazy as all the rest of the wolves in his Da's pack.
"Another time," Charles told Tag and Brother Wolf both. "Someday when there isn't a job to do." "Just for fun," agreed Tag.
Anna looked back and forth between them and rolled her eyes.
"I guess since Hester fell for both Jonesy and me, she had a thing for dangerous men," Tag told Anna.
He grinned, but there was an edge to it that might have had something to do with the exchange with Charles, or it might have been grief,
or both. "Jonesy was all right back then," he said. Mostly all right, but there was a dust-up with some of his people, some of whom died who shouldn't have. He went from being wobbly at times to full-out tilt-a-whirl. Hester took care of him."
"I thought Hester was supposed to be wobbly, too," said Anna, "though she seemed pretty sharp today."
"Hester was as stable as me,"
Tag told her.
"Well, no. Better than I am."
He looked at Charles for a moment, then shook his head. He tipped his chin toward Anna.
"As sane as you are."
She tried hunting Dodd down last time he was here, Charles said dryly. Sane people usually don't try that. Tag gave him an agreeable look under his brow.
Hester and Brian, they went out of their way to make Hester sound crazier than she was. Especially if Jonesy was having troubles more than usual. Make sure that no one except he or I came up here. Keep everyone wary of Hester. Like all the wildlings, they were here on sufferance, and the Merrock's power kept the other Grey Lords from bothering Jonesy. If Bran made them leave, they would have been on their own, and that would have been disastrous. For everyone.
Other Grey Lords, Charles said. Tag made a noise.
Well, he wasn't a Grey Lord, not really. Not by his choice, anyhow. But with his parentage, it wasn't something he could easily get out of. And if any of the Fae with an ounce of sense had talked to Jonesy this past 50 years, they'd have hunted him down and killed him. Had to. They take care of their problems, same as us.
Would they? Asked Anna.
Did they?
Do you think this was something aimed at Jonesy? Because one of the Fae found out he was here? Tag pursed his lips, but before he or Charles could say anything, Anna was already shaking her head. No, sorry. This was a werewolf thing. Werewolves working with humans and technology. She indicated Charles's already mostly filled backpack. A Grey Lord wouldn't need technology to spy on someone.
Maybe. Maybe not, said Charles. It's too early to rule anything out. It doesn't look like it from where we're standing, but that could change.
A Grey Lord might put all the cameras in place and zap them himself just to watch us run around like halfwits, muttered Tag. Some of those guys are really off-kilter.
Charles took pride in the self-control that allowed him not to respond to the maybe unintentional irony in that statement. His self-control was aided by the short time it had to stay strong, because from somewhere out of sight, Asil called,
I've got another one up here for you techies. Está roto. What is it you said about the last one, Tag? Pretty borked? This one is pretty borked, too.
Calming, Tag called back.
The three of them headed toward Asil. Ducking through some underbrush, they came upon a fresh break in the ground, some 3 feet across, 15 feet long, and maybe 12 feet down. Probably the crack was due to Jonesy's earthquakes. Roots were stretched from one side to the other, the damage from the sudden wrenching obvious. One tree leaned precariously, its root ball rising out of the otherwise stable side of the tree. Next storm or heavy snow, and it would fall, Charles judged. Several hundred years of life, now dying a slow death. It was not the oldest fatality this day, nor the only tree to fall. But Charles was tired of death, and the trees were entirely innocent. Brother Wolf wasn't tired of death, just tired of the deaths of those who had belonged to them, who were theirs to protect. He would be happy to kill all of the ones responsible for this attack on their territory. Very happy. Anna slipped her hand under Charles's tee, just at the small of his back, and let her fingers rest against the skin there. Brother Wolf relaxed. Anna made Brother Wolf happier than killing their enemies would have.
Not sure it wouldn't have been smarter to have Jonesy put down when he went funny,
Tag said thoughtfully, looking at the damage.
Luke's children are too damn powerful by half to let run around without a sense God gave a goose. But he was Hester's mate, and she wouldn't have survived his death any more than he survived hers.
On the last word, he jumped across the broken ground. Charles waited for Anna to make the jump. She had no trouble with it, and he didn't expect her to, but some things were ingrained, and he liked to watch her move. She was economical, so much so that it was easy to underestimate just how strong she was. He liked that about her, the way she could pass for human. It made her safer. As he jumped, part of him was locked onto how well Anna's genes showed off her muscular curves. Part of him noted that she still had that witchcrafted gun tucked in the waistband of her jeans. But the biggest part of his attention was still stuck on Tag's rambling dialogue.
"Lou's children," he'd said.
There was only one Lou Tag could have been talking about when referring to a fae. Charles had met a son of Lou once, in Boston. He'd rather that none of the ancient fae god's progeny had ever been located within 1,000 miles of his home. He regretted Jonesy's death, but the chasm, small as it was, gave evidence of how much more Hester's death could have cost his pack. He thought of what he would do if someone killed his Anna. And part of him, Charles and Brother Wolf both, thought the less of Jonesy for not defying Hester's wishes and laying waste to the world for her sake.
"Finally, children, I had despaired of you reaching me in this century."
Asil's voice came from somewhere in the mass of evergreen branches directly over their heads.
"Your slowness has not been without benefit, however. It allowed me leisure to locate 3 more devices of some sort in a direct line from this one in this tree. Our enemies were very industrious."
Over the course of the next few hours, if they didn't find all of the electronics the invaders had left, they probably found everything within a mile of Hester's house. Charles was at least absolutely certain that the pack left nothing any human-based investigators would be able to find.
"You seem to be awfully worried about human authorities," commented Asil,
dusting off the dirt and debris that an afternoon of tree climbing had left on him.
"Do you think this might be the U.S. government who dropped in to visit?"
Sage, who was seldom to be found too far from Asil if he was present, looked at Charles, echoing Asil's question without speaking a word.
"I don't," Charles said. "At least not directly. As far as I can tell, the government is as happy with werewolves as they have ever been. But a government is made of individuals. And there are plenty of those who are afraid of us, of the Fae, and all the other things they know are out there in the night."
"Can't blame them," said Sage softly. "They call us monsters for a reason. And werewolves are just the tip of the iceberg. I could tell you some stories."
Sage had her own nightmares suffered at werewolf hands. That his Da had found out about her and rescued her as soon as he heard didn't mean that she loved being a werewolf any more than most of those who'd been changed against their wishes. Anna, who, as far as Charles could see, seemed to have embraced her wolf without bitterness, gave Sage a sharp look.
"Hating all werewolves or fae makes as much sense as hating all humans," she said mildly.
Asil smiled at her, a smile both patronizing and affectionate.
"Ah," he told her. "But you are a child of your generation, raised by people who grew up in the 1960s and taught that people are not to be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. That profiling by race, religion, or species is anathema, no matter how useful."
If Asil had realized his expression was also wistful, doubtless the old Moor would have found a different smile for Anna.
"Werewolves are a bit more frightening than a black man in an all-white restaurant," said Sage.
Anna pursed her lip. Her father was a high-profile liberal lawyer who'd started his practice defending protesters, which gave her a certain perspective on the subject.
"Not to someone raised in ignorance," she said. "The unknown is a lot more scary than something you understand, no matter how bad that is."
"It isn't the ignorant," said Asil softly, "who fear our kind. And their fear is not baseless. What do you think would happen if Bran chose to take over the government?"
Sage started to speak, then her face went blank, except for the narrowing of her eyes. Asil nodded toward her.
"Yes, you see it, don't you?
We hear all the time that the Fae couldn't do it. They are too few for all of their power. Human weapons have advanced unimaginably far since my birth. Eventually, in any match of strength to strength, they would win an outright battle with any of us on the supernaturally endowed spectrum. The vampires. I think the vampires believe that they are in control. That spider in Europe could no more resist allowing the government to run without unwitting slaves in key positions than he could resist poking his fingers into the Nazi pie in the middle of the last century. But if Bran wanted it...
Anna, her eyes bright, was still mouthing supernaturally endowed spectrum at Charles when Sage murmured,
Bran is more subtle than the vampires. Even Bonarata, Bran is like everyone's favorite big brother. He's charming. He looks so harmless until he doesn't. And you know that he really does care.
My da, said Charles dryly. Dictator at large.
Well, yes, said Anna, recovering from her amusement. Of course, he could make a fine stab at it. But since he really doesn't care about anyone who doesn't turn furry in the full moon, I'd rather he leave the government to the humans.
And so would Da,
agreed Charles.
But if he wanted to,
said Sage, her voice soft.
No,
said Charles firmly. It wouldn't be as easy as Asil makes it sound.
I'd help, said Asil.
But the seriousness had gone out of the moment. Anna made a pithy sound.
Seduce the women,
she said, her accent a flawless copy of Asil's.
It is the women who run everything anyway. If a man's wife says, do this, he does. Simple. If you want the government to do thus and such, get their wives and mistresses on board.
It sounded like a quote. Charles gave Asil an interested look.
I was teaching Kara about your revolutionary war, Asil said, with dignity.
Sage grinned. She was a beautiful woman, but her grin transformed her face, made her less beautiful and more approachable.
Or how Benjamin Franklin's skill between the sheets managed to win the war.
Which is true, said Asil.
True-ish, admonished Sage. And in current times, incredibly sexist. A lot of the people in power are women. What are you going to do, seduce their husbands?
Asil smiled slowly, his eyes bright.
Want to watch?
Getting back to your question, children, said Charles, deliberately using the word Asil liked so much. Assuming we can put world domination, sexual politics of the 18th century, and flirting aside for the moment, I don't think this is a government operation. Too much money in some areas and not enough in others. That doesn't mean there isn't some glory hound watching for a chance to change the game. I don't want to give anyone something they can hold over us. He dumped his overfull backpack on the bed of the nearest convenient truck, and Anna did the same with hers. Laid out in the open, it made an interesting pile in several ways. Tag pursed his lips.
Helicopter. Train man and werewolves. $20,000 of equipment, you're right. Too much money to be casual, but not enough for official government.
Anna sorted out the tech by nose until she had three piles.
Tech guy the first, she said, pointing at one pile. Tech girl was the second pile. Tech guy the second was the third pile. Just guessing, but from the wear and tear and the scent of tech gurus, this was set up in three waves.
Tag nodded his agreement.
That first group was out here last fall. You can see the effects of winter, maybe 8 months ago. The second was put out this spring. The third batch looks new, 2 weeks, maybe a month. Each set of equipment is top-flight, bleeding-edge stuff. I was off by maybe 10,000 on the cost.
He tapped his finger on the first group.
Prices on this have gone down since last winter. Someone spent 30 grand on tech to keep watch on Hester and Jonesy.
who mostly didn't do anything interesting.
I bet they wanted to know what they were going to be dealing with, Sage said thoughtfully. I mean, they came here specifically for Hester. That damned cage was meant to hold a werewolf. Maybe they were being careful, trying to make sure they knew what they were getting into. Tag grinned suddenly, showing his teeth.
Jonesy, I didn't catch it until it was all laid out.
He looked at Charles.
Did you see the pattern?
He did.
Jonesy found all of the tech when it went up. Probably right away, Charles said, thinking of the forest spirits. The Fae probably had some other name for them, interacted with them in some other fashion than Charles did, but they had been much too in tune with Jonesy, and with his death, for them not to have had some kind of contact with him. The oldest set were simply disabled, the power destroyed with a surgical blow.
Zap!
Said Tag, popping his lips.
The second bunch were damaged a little more severely, Charles said.
Double zap, said Tag.
That is not a technical term, I hope, murmured Asil.
Only the most technically advanced people can use double zap correctly,
Anna told Asil, sotto voce.
You and I shouldn't try it.
By the third wave, Tag said, Jonesy was insulted. He was a chess player, and these idiots had used the same strategy 3 times in a row and expected different results. Thus, this third wave of tech is not just zap or double zap, but truly barked.
So why didn't he tell Hester about them? Anna asked. Or did he? Did she know they were being watched? Why didn't she tell Bran? Somberly, Sage said,
The only people who know the answer to that are dead.
Charles found himself considering that last question. Tag said Hester was faking her troubles so that she could protect Jonesy. He said, and Charles agreed with him, that probably Bran had known that. So why hadn't she called his father about the planes that had been flying over them? Had she known they had people trying to spy on them? But as Sage said, the only people who knew that were dead. Unless, he thought, Hester had called his Da. He considered that for a moment, and decided that, while certainly possible, the idea that his Da had known about someone's flying over Hester's cabin and not alerted the pack carried some uncomfortable possibilities with it. The ground around the wooden building was raw, where the backhoe Tag brought up had done its work. After careful consideration, the chainsaws that had cut the ATVs free had been employed again to cut down a tree that stood midway between the house and the rest of the forest. Better to lose one centuries-old tree than thousands of them. They laid Hester on the bed next to the remains of her mate. The room was too small to hold the pack, so they entered the cabin in twos and threes while the wind played background music, with the trees as its instrument. Charles let Leia and Anna sort the shuffle of pack and sought out Asil, who stood a little distance from all the hustle.
Fire, Charles said, may be a purifying force, but it is not one of the usual methods of destroying Fey magic.
Asil made a considering noise.
Do you think there are Fey artifacts in that cabin?
I didn't feel anything when Anna and I were in there earlier, he told the Moor honestly. But according to Tag and to Brother Wolf's independent assessment, Jonesy was a power. I think he could hide his toys well enough that they would not attract my casual attention.
Asil said nothing for a moment.
You think I could find them?
Charles chose his words carefully, because flattery was not something he did. Anna had often suggested it as a good way to get cooperation from Asil, and pointed out that the most effective flattery had only truth. Charles decided that now was as good a time as ever to test out her advice.
I think that any wolf who has survived as long as you have has at least as much a nose for fey magic as I do. I would appreciate it
if you would come down there with me and help look. I've asked Anna and Tag to keep the crowd occupied with stories about Hester while we go in. The Moor snorted.
You just want help searching the field for landmines, and they're looking for cannon fodder.
But despite his words,